All right, welcome to Useful Idiots.
Welcome to Useful Idiots.
I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
How do you feel, Katie?
Meh, I've felt better.
Yeah, you were sick.
I have been sick. I am sick. I will be sick.
Are you feeling better now, though?
A little.
A little.
It's been a while. But thank you for asking. And you?
Yeah. I feel, I'm quite well, actually.
Oh,
I had a really good weekend. I'm really happy. I spent a lot of time with my family. And so now let's wreck it. Let's talk about politics.
It's
really depressing stuff. But we have a great show.
We're going to talk to
Crystal Ball and Sagar Anjedi, right?
Authors of The Populist Guide to 2020. A New Left and a New Right Are Rising.
Right.
And their
because they are the hosts of
Rising
on the Hill,
on
right?
The Hill,
so
TV,
that's
yeah.
It's a great discussion.
Both been on Full Disclosure.
Yeah, the Friends of Show FOS.
Yeah, FOS. Yeah,
or FSOS.
I think FOS is better.
FOS.
Yeah,
great discussion, and we got a whole bunch of stuff to get to with the campaign. So let's get to it.
Let's get to it.
And we're going to go through all kinds of stuff about the campaign, and there was lots and lots of craziness as usual.
So much.
So we should start with the four food groups. Mm-hmm. Republicans suck. Democrats suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible?
Terrible.
For Democrats suck this week. It's not really Democrats. It's just. It's a thing that's popping up that we started to see in 2016, and now it's here again. The Washington Post ran an op-ed, and the headline is, "It's time to give elites a bigger say in the primary." And this happened in 2016 when Trump won the primaries on the Republican side. You started to see these too much democracy articles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there such a thing as too much democracy? And now we're getting this because Bernie's doing well. So basically, what the piece says is that it wants us to do a ranked choice system, right? Because what it's saying is, and it's here's the quote. It says, what this system is not great at is choosing among the many candidates who clear the bar for nomination, or bringing their different ideological factions together, or reconciling competing priorities. And what they're basically saying here is, right now we have a situation where there are a whole bunch of, like, quote unquote centrist candidates,
mm-hmm.
and they just haven't done a good job of consolidating
all those
factions together to beat back basically Bernie Sanders. I mean, that's the subtext of this whole thing.
Yeah.
I hate to make this show about that all the time. But basically all this is saying is that this system is producing a bad result because we're getting people voting for this person when we want them to vote for another person.
Right, when we don't like him.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, it's funny because I think ranked, a lot of people who are progressive like ranked choice voting.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that the person who wrote this doesn't really care about ranked choice voting. They just care about finding something that will make Sanders not do well.
Right.
Chance the Rapper likes ranked choice voting, by the way.
No, I mean, I like ranked choice voting. I mean, I like it in a parliamentary system, though,
yeah.
because that's the whole idea is to get a proportional representation
right.
in government. This is not what you'd be doing. The whole idea here is that and here's the way they put it. The point is to build a way for party elites to understand what their base is thinking and to allow them to bargain so that these different preferences and priorities can be balanced, right? And
The
elites know what the voters are thinking. They can tell by who they're voting for.
Yeah,
they just don't want to support that person.
That's why they're writing this piece.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's funny. I clicked on the article, and of course, it was like paywalled,
which is ironic.
Yeah.
Right.
But this is. I mean, I actually appreciate it. I appreciate how much they're just wearing their hearts on their sleeves or putting their cards on the table. They're just like, we need more concentration of power.
Right, so this all started in 2016. The Brookings Institute did a piece.
They're the liberal think tank.
Yeah, kind of. Right.
Well, they characterize themselves that way.
But everybody was doing this back then, and their article was, "Is too much democracy responsible for the rise of Trump?" And then later on in November, we had the Wall Street Journal doing an amazing editorial, which said it was entitled "It's Time to Bring Back the Smoke-Filled Room." So they're being open about this. They want to go back to the days when people decide, when there's a group of deciders instead of voters.
They should have a poll tax again.
You think?
Maybe. I mean, these people should suggest that. And then there's that Atlantic headline.
Yeah, is too much democracy is bad for democracy. I mean, there was a ton of this. Andrew Sullivan did a piece, which is actually kind of interesting. But he wrote one back then. It was huge.
But it's not that weird that, like, the Wall Street Journal says this or Andrew Sullivan. But it is kind of weird, I think, that Brookings Institute says it. I mean, it's not weird, but it is weird. Again, they're just wearing it on their sleeves.
Whenever you get a result when it's a populist movement right. that's going to defy the wishes of a bunch of institutionally, you know, chosen people, you're going to get this kind of a thing. And
yeah.
people are going to see the downside to democracy.
Right.
And they're going to make all kinds of arguments like, oh, think about how inefficient it would be if we had direct democracy for everything.
Right.
I mean, you're going to start to see a lot of those arguments.
But imagine thinking like the reason that Trump rose to power is because we have too much democracy.
Right. Well, I mean, I can see how you can make that argument.
But
basically, the party, you know, there are controls that traditionally existed to make sure that, you know, the choice of the party would be somebody
right.
who was acceptable to everybody. So you had the, you know, the media was one barrier, or the party itself was another barrier, right? You needed to have donors. All those people needed to agree.
Right.
And, you know, Trump kind of smashed that whole model. And
yes.
what they're saying is we need to have a model, basically.
Right. I mean, more decorum also. And, like, the real honest takeaway, of course, is that, like, how much democracy has failed, or how much institutions have
right.
failed, and that there isn't, you know, if there were actual more lowercase d democracy, so people wouldn't be turning to Trump.
Yeah, and all they're really saying is that we know better than voters.
Right.
Voters ultimately are ignorant. They make bad choices. So we need to have some kind of safeguard
there.
So.
There's no introspection whatsoever. Like, they don't care about what's behind it because
right.
they just want to keep their consulting jobs, and they want to, like, hold on to their ideology and the idea that the status quo was okay.
And they don't realize that people are voting this way precisely because they hate
people
all
like
those guardians and those
yeah.
self-appointed, you know.
Right, because they hate people who say that
vanguards.
Elites need more power.
Right, exactly. So it's ironic. We're going to start to see more of this, though, as Bernie does better. So what do we have for Republican suck?
For Republican suck, we have one of my favorites, Jennifer Rubin, who has a column at the Washington Post called Right Turn, in case you were curious about her orientation. She's a neocon. She used to say terrible things about Obama. Anyway, so she, about Bernie, of course, said, oh, let's pick the socialist who had a heart attack and won't release his med records and turns up his nose at millions to fund the campaign. Brilliant, just brilliant. So I love watching, I tweeted, like, I love watching her lose her racist neocon mind. And it is true. Jennifer Rubin has about, like, a weekly column on Sanders. She once wrote, like, is he past his sell-by date? And I don't mean to be something, but...
Well, she's as monomaniacally against Sanders as you are for him, though.
Sure.
Right?
But I admit it.
Right. Okay.
And I don't have a Washington Post column, although
That's
I
true.
Should.
Right.
Because I'm much more honest than she is.
Right. She's really... tough to read.
Yeah, she's tough to read. And also, can I say
it's like
this?
She writes with a fork.
Yeah, I don't know why it's not embarrassing to the resistance to have people like her in it. Like,
well,
Media Matters used to have all these examples of terrible things that she would say.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Sullivan said she was Islamophobic.
Right, right. Well, you know, I mean, there's been a change in the orientation. I mean, we've got Bill Kristol and David Frum and all those
right.
folks. Those are now the kind of...
Who's the worst?
They're all kind of the same. But this, you know, this thing with the health records... it's not going to go away,
right.
by the way. I mean, and look, to be fair, Sanders did have a heart attack. He's an old guy who had a heart attack.
Yeah.
So this question is not going to go away. And, you know, I think the way that the Sanders campaign characterizing this as a smear campaign and everything, I don't know that that's right.
Well, he released the smear part is that they're presenting it like he's being dishonest now.
Right.
Like, yeah, there were arguments about the way he unrolled the news last time.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep changing the goalposts. So he released his records, and they're like, oh, no, but we want more. We want more information.
Sure.
And they are talking about it as if it's the standard that he's violating.
Right.
But that's just not the case.
Right. There's no standard, but that doesn't mean the question's illegitimate either. So, and, you know, he's
no,
going to keep quoting
hypocrisy,
that question.
Yeah, but it's the hypocrisy of people who are asking it. And also, like, again, Joe Biden bled from his eye on national television.
And he's clearly insane.
And he had brain surgery.
Right.
And, like... why aren't people asking for more details from him?
Yeah.
It just, I mean...
They should have minute-to-minute brain scans of Joe Biden. In fact, that should
be
like
amazing.
A live graphic on CNN during the debates.
Yes.
You know, you could see the little
where
lights
it lights
going
up.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would
be
great.
Amazing.
His memory center, he's thinking about grapes
corn
now.
Pop,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a corn pop place in his brain? What does she mean, and turns up his nose at millions to fund a campaign?
I mean, I think what she's saying is that he's unilaterally disarming in the fight against Trump. In other words, because he's not going to accept funding from all the usual sources.
Right.
I'm guessing.
She has no...
saying.
Well, she's like she might as well She, I'm sure, also bemoans the fact that elites don't have more power. She doesn't understand why that's actually something that's not just morally valuable, but strategic on Sanders' part.
Right, right.
That gets him votes.
Yeah.
That position.
Yeah, and this came up in 2016, too, the whole funding idea that we can't unilaterally disarm. We have to, you know, if they're doing it, we have to do
right,
it.
Yeah.
But is wrong. I think we're going to test that hypothesis this year. But, well, depends. If, you know, Bloomberg becomes the nominee, then we're going to really not test it. But it's interesting. All right, for Isn't That Weird, this is like one of my favorite genres of news stories, which is the something weird turns up 50 years later.
Yeah.
So a million years ago when I was in Russia, I did a story about somebody who mailed a letter actually from Finland to Russia during the Tsarist years, and it arrived in the 90s. And so this is like a different story. Class ring in Maine. Class ring lost in Maine turns up 50 years later in Finland.
And Finland's always at the center.
It was buried under 8 inches of dirt in a park in Finland. So a couple that lost a class ring in Maine 50 years ago, that ring has just turned up inscribed, and it was sent back to the woman in Maine this week, which is, I just love that these kinds of stories.
I lost my great-grandmother's engagement ring. Or wedding ring.
Did you?
I'm so upset about it, yeah. Every
is it
now
in
and
Finland?
Then it haunts me. I don't know where it is. If you're watching this, I think I lost it at a restaurant on the Upper East Side. It was awful because I met two women there at the time I was like involved in the Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group.
Mm-hmm.
And I met two women to talk about it there. And one of them was like really sympathetic to killing Gazans.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being like, really? I have to sit here? And as if that's not bad enough, then I lost my great-grandmother's wedding ring.
Where do you think it is now?
I don't know.
Do you think it's on a different continent?
Nah, I think it's somewhere here. Sorry, I didn't mean to hog the
no, that's
isn't
right.
that weird
that's
story.
Right. I love these stories. They often involve a pet, these stories. Like somebody loses a pet and it turns up like in another continent.
Oh, wow.
You know, like there's a woman lost a cat in Wisconsin once and it showed up in France.
Finland.
Not Finland. France.
Oh, this is real. I thought you were making it just like grabbing out of thin air.
The cat ran away in Wisconsin and they got a call. Like the cat somehow ended up in a flatbed truck and went all the way to France and they found it and they called her, you know.
Wow.
So these stories happen all the time.
Is the cat
I love
like
it.
A francophile?
I don't know why. I don't think the cat intentionally chose to go to France, but it just happened.
Wow, way to deny the cat agency, Matt.
What do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
Oh, my God. For Isn't That Terrible, I found a story about a case of dolphinicide, dolphin murder. So there have been 3 dolphin murders now. And guess where, of course? Where does terrible stuff happen always?
Florida?
Florida, yeah. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is offering $20,000 for information on a dolphin killer or killers after 2 animals were found dead within a week. Biologists with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission found a dolphin that appeared to have been shot in the face off Naples late last week, shortly before experts with the Emerald Coast Wildlife Refuge found a dolphin on the Pensacola shoreline with a bullet hole in its left side, reports the Miami Herald. This follows the discovery last summer of a dolphin impaled near its right eye along Upper Captiva Island west of Fort Myers. It was in begging posture, as was the dolphin found off Naples.
So the dolphin was begging for its life when somebody impaled it?
What does that mean? That is so awful. What's begging posture? I don't even want to know what that is.
We have a dolphin serial killer?
Yeah. I want that person to get the death penalty. And I don't even believe in the death penalty.
Well, you'll make an exception for
this. I want that person to be killed by sharks. That's how I can reconcile my hatred of sharks, which people find problematic, because I've said in the past that I want them to be extinct. But right. I will change my position if we can use them to kill dolphin killers.
Right. You just want to throw this person over, like douse the person in pig blood and throw him overboard.
Without killing a pig. It has to be a naturally died pig that naturally died.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is terrible. I mean, somebody's out there literally for enjoyment shooting dolphins in the face. That's about
it's
as fucked
so
up as you
awful.
Can, like, that's like the worst person you can possibly
imagine.
And
dolphins are so nice.
They are.
I bet that if we brought the guy, if we brought him in and told the dolphins, like, that's the one who killed your family,
right?
They wouldn't do anything.
They would.
No, they would be like...
Dolphins are strong. They could nub the guy to death.
No, but they wouldn't want to because they're peace-loving animals.
Yeah, I don't know.
And that's when we would invite the sharks in.
They're carnivores.
I know, but I feel like they're the people whose relatives are killed and they don't want
to. I'm not saying they deserve to get shot in the face.
Yeah, but come on. They also, you know, that story about a guy swimming and dolphins surrounded him like in a circle because they wanted to protect him from sharks.
No, that's true. They're great animals. Nobody should be running around impaling dolphins in the eye.
I know. They should be impaled, or they should just, I would like for the dolphin to impale them back. I just think they're too peace loving, but maybe not.
Right.
I told you I went swimming with them, so I'm extra sensitive. They pushed. Did I tell you I was like a little? I was 11, I think, in Mexico, and they pushed their noses into the arches of my foot. Like, that's how they do it. There's one dolphin behind each foot, and they go like that, and you kind of like come up like some winged victory statue.
That is a terrible. That is a legitimately terrible news story. So what do we have this week? I guess we should tell people
the merch.
Yeah, first of all, where they can buy merch.
So we got merch. Look, we got these beautiful cups. We got T-shirts and totes, and the tote bag has an inner pocket, which is really cool.
Has it come in handy already?
Yeah, definitely.
And where can they find this?
Well, so that's an interesting story. People have been saying that they don't know how to find them, so let's walk them through it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of options. One is you go to teespring.com, that's T-E-E, spring.com/stores/useful-idiots. Or if you go to our YouTube video, is it in it? So you go to our YouTube video, and in the description, there will be a link.
Mm-hmm.
And you click on that link.
I see.
And this is right before or after you rate and review us, give us a positive review.
Right.
You give Positive America a negative review.
Right.
Or just...
Just cast them out of your mind
yeah,
completely.
Just yeah. Write their name down on a piece of paper and then
throw
scribble
it in a roaring
over.
Fire.
Yeah. And it's great. Makes for great gifts.
You said that so convincingly.
Did I not sound convincing?
No, you're convincing. Okay, so that's how you can buy merch. All right. Our sports discussions have been really popular. I think people really look forward to your insights in sports. So we have a topic that I think everybody wants to know your take on, which is, where is Tom Brady going to sign? I mean...
On the dotted line.
Yeah, on the... Eventually, probably that is where he will sign.
Yeah.
Physically on a piece of paper.
If I know him to be the traditionalist.
Do you have an in with Tom Brady?
I don't.
Are you close to Alex Guerrero and that whole crew? Is that your route to Brady through on the fitness side or what?
It's more his anti-gun violence work.
Tom Brady does anti-gun violence work?
The Brady.
That's a different Brady. That's James Brady,
Dream
the one
Brady.
Who got that in dolphin-like fashion got shot in the face.
Oh, my God, he got dolphined, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
No relation. Okay.
No.
The way I know Tom Brady is the way everyone knows him.
Well, what do you think the criteria is going to – is he going to choose – what's he going to value more? Money, winability, weapons? What's the most important thing for him? And
well, not weapons, because the gun thing.
Because of the gun thing.
He's anti-gun
violence. So he wants to go somewhere he doesn't have weapons. So why doesn't he just stay in New England then?
Well, New England's cold.
Right.
And he's been there for how long now?
20 years, yeah.
Yeah, so he's tired of it, and he doesn't like the mass holes.
He doesn't like the mass holes,
yeah.
Right. Okay, so where's he going to go? If you had to rank, what's your leaderboard for Brady destinations?
Give me a choice, like give me a quadrant of the United States.
Let's throw some out there. If you had to choose between Tennessee, Vegas, L.A., Chargers, obviously, not Rams.
Right.
Tennessee, where do you think among those?
Tennessee.
Tennessee
is
where he's going to stay?
Yeah.
All right.
He's going to stay.
No, it's where he's going to go.
Oh, yeah.
And is he going to sign before or after the start of free agency?
Free agency is such a... I mean, I don't even know how to define it.
Like, how would you define free agency?
I mean, isn't that a whole philosophical debate, whether we have it?
Whether we as human beings have agency in the universe?
Free agency, yeah. It's a big, you know, all the philosophers
that,
have debated
that. Is what we're talking about, yeah.
So...
Does mankind have... Do human beings have free will?
Right, that's what I'm saying.
That's like, what we discuss at the beginning of every March in the new league year.
Yeah, so I think that, honestly, I reject the premise because we always have free will. So Tom Brady already has free agency right now.
Huh.
So
he's already a free agent.
Yeah.
As a human being, making his way through the universe, he's showing his agency as a person already.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so he doesn't think his history is preordained.
No,
he's
not a Calvinist.
Choices, even now.
Yeah,
even
he's making choices.
Even before the technical start of free agency, he's already making those
choices.
When
is that technical start?
In the beginning of March. Dan, when is it? What's the date?
Yeah. Well, tell me more about him. Make sure I'm thinking of the right one.
So he's the quarterback from the Patriots.
Right.
He's a six-time Super Bowl champion, been to 9 Super Bowls. He's handsome.
Yeah.
He has a supermodel wife. He's an icon in Massachusetts, but... for the first time, it's possible that he's not coming back to the Patriots. So there's lots and lots.
Why wouldn't he come back?
For a lot of reasons. There's a relationship issue between him and the coach.
Right.
He's been there for a million years. Yeah. I'm not sure whether they want to invest in an old person.
Yeah, he needs a change of scenery.
He needs a change of scenery.
The tension between him and the coach is too much.
Coach Belichick.
Coach Belichick, who I remember him from something else. Wasn't he involved in some
Spygate, yeah.
Was Inflategate or something?
That was Brady.
Oh, it was Brady, yeah. You see, I was right.
Yeah.
I knew it was familiar.
Deflategate, not
Deflategate.
Yeah. All right, so you're bidding on Tennessee.
Yeah, I think the Smoky Mountains, the music.
I'm going to bet on L.A. So
they do
all
have
the
nice
record.
Weather. Yeah.
Chargers, right? But according to Katie, we all have free agency all the time.
There, yeah.
So it's already free agency, and that's a good point. All right, so what else do we have? We have something from.
Bloomberg is entering the race, and our good friend James Adomian, who must come on the show. He's been on the Katie Halper show, and he really wants to come on this show, actually. I don't want to overrate him. He's one of the funniest impersonators.
Right.
And what makes him so good is that he's not just really good at the mimicry, but he's like so gets the political and cultural references.
Right.
And he knows a lot about politics. And he was actually a theater econ double major in college. So he made this Bloomberg ad.
I'm Michael Bloomberg, and I'm running for president because I can. Why? Because I have $50 billion. So running for president to me is almost like going out and buying some ice cream. Oh, what do you know? Ice cream. That's the kind of thing that people who don't pay much attention to politics think is kind of cool when the guy who invented the stop and frisk policy in New York City is trying to buy an election. I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I'm buying this ad spot in the middle of this other ad just to let you know the scale at which I am able to buy this election. It actually confuses you. It ruins the last ad to have this ad bought in the middle of the former ad that still got... I'm Michael Bloomberg. Gratuitously, I'm adding an ad within the ad to the other ad. Why? To show you that I can throw money around like it's on fire. I'm Michael Bloomberg, and this is an ad within an ad that's within an ad, and I think that might even be within another ad. I can't even keep count. We are four levels down. I'm buying ad space inside of my own ad space. Why? Because I want you to wake up thinking Michael Bloomberg. Hey, Mike, I'll take over from here. That's Mike Bloomberg, and I'm Mike Bloomberg, and resistance is futile. I'm Michael Bloomberg, and I'm buying this election. I want you to start your day, even with the television off, knowing that you're probably incidentally going to hear a Michael Bloomberg ad sometime during the day. I'm Michael Bloomberg. Fuck you. Fuck all of you. Buying the election, and we're buying ad time, even on our own ads. I'm Mike Bloomberg, and this is how the nightmare begins. I'm Michael Bloomberg. You're back at the original ad. If you're thinking, I don't support Michael Bloomberg, that's what everybody's thinking. But let me tell you something. Nobody supports Michael Bloomberg. And yet all these people are working on my commercials. Why? Because I have that much money to throw at them. You might think I will make a terrible president and that someday there's going to be robot dog police and stop and frisk across this fucking country and drone strikes domestically to anybody who pipes up the way Occupy Wall Street did. And you know what? You're right. And that's why I'm running for president, because there's no way to stop me. Yummy. I'm Michael Bloomberg, and I approve this mess.
Fuck you.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's from James Domian, who has a great podcast called The Underculture.
It's great.
Which
it's terrifying. It's true.
Yeah. He is really so scary, Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah. I mean, what he's doing is unprecedented and horrible. He's actually, I think, just genuinely a bad person.
Yeah.
Bloomberg. Like,
yeah,
you know,
he's supposed to be really
underneath
vile
his hideous political
boss.
Exterior.
Right.
Like underneath the bad exterior, there's a worse exterior.
Right,
like,
that
a worse
we can't even
thing,
see, that we haven't even seen yet, yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, the question is, how did we get Bloomberg, right? Where did he come from? And this answer that we have from Pod Save America, a friend of the show, Pod Save America host Jon Favreau, is kind of like the podcast equivalent of the elites need to have more power,
right.
I think. So let's hear what he has to say about this.
Look, I think the other thing that's tough here is there's a lot of folks on the left who spent a lot of this campaign telling us that Pete Buttigieg is some centrist shill and not a good enough Democrat, and Joe Biden is not a good enough Democrat, and Amy Klobuchar is not a good enough Democrat. And it's like, now we have someone in Mike Bloomberg who really isn't a good enough Democrat, who really is a moderate Republican. And because a lot of times they spent this entire campaign telling us that good mainstream Democrats like Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and Joe Biden aren't good enough for us, it's going to be harder for a lot of people to believe that that's true about Mike Bloomberg when it is true about Mike Bloomberg.
This is the fable we will tell our children. The boy who cried centrist.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a lot to unpack there.
This is the fable we're going to tell our children. It's a boring fucking fable.
Yeah, and this is from Ben Dixon, who tweeted this, in which I guess this John Pod Save America blames the rise of Bloomberg on leftists being mean to centrists as opposed to Bloomberg buying democracy, media manufacturing consent, party assisting him instead of blocking him. Brilliance.
Yeah. And that last point is really, really true, by the way. Like, you know, the party bent the rules to let it to allow Bloomberg to buy his way into the debates.
Yeah. He's not even on the ballot in Nevada.
Is he not? Really? Interesting. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Owen Higgins had a good tweet about this also, saying, like, you know, if I were a supporter of Tulsi or not to, of Castro or Harris or Booker or anyone who didn't make it into the debates, I'd be furious about.
Yeah, you should be, because they told all those people we're not going to bend the rules for anybody, and then they did bend the rules for him. And look, this guy is not a Democrat in any – I mean, there's nothing about him that's –
No,
you know,
and I think it's actually extreme – this is like voter shaming, what Jon Favreau is doing, and it's like the elite argument, and it's these people are so out of touch that they don't even realize how out of touch they come off.
Right.
And it's like, no – that's not how politics works. It's not like, oh, we've wasted our wad. We've blown our wad on arguing that Pete Buttigieg is centrist, and now there's a real centrist Republican, and now we've wasted that argument. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, it's not like there's not like a finite number of people that you can say are terrible. And they could all be terrible.
Yeah, and also like you could argue that that shifts. We've shifted the Overton window to the left by criticizing Buttigieg, and that makes Bloomberg that much less electable.
I'm trying to go through my whole life without ever actually using the phrase the Overton window.
Yeah. It's pretty good, though.
Yeah?
Have you never?
Is it good?
You just did it.
I know I just did it, but does that count?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. All right. Well, then I just ruined it. Yeah.
I just think that's so ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And
that's like saying
it's a faulty syllogism, basically.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So it's terrible.
But Matt, that's the fable we will tell our children.
It's
the
fable
boy who cried centrist.
Yeah. 20 years from now, that's what we're going to be. You're going to be sitting
Why
down
did Michael Bloomberg win the presidency? Well,
you
see,
there
are these
you.
Leftists who were critical of Pete Buttigieg.
Because he didn't stand for anything, and Amy Klobuchar because she told the same joke over and over again.
Right, and opposed Medicare for All, and Biden because he bleeds from his eye.
Right,
and was created an
suffering
entire prison.
A severe degenerative neurological disease on live television for a year.
Yeah, and gave his son a nice job on Amtrak.
Right. Helped him. Yeah.
Helped him. Yeah. That to me is the biggest corruption.
Well, my favorite thing about that is when the letter. We talked about
that. Hunter Biden
he rides the trains.
He got nominated to he was a member of the board of Amtrak. Right.
Yeah.
And his qualification.
And the recommendation
letter
was from Tom Carper to the Amtrak board. Basically says Hunter Biden has spent a lot of time on Amtrak trains.
Yeah.
That was in the recommendation, which was one of the all time. That's like the all-time nepotism. That's worse than nepotism, actually. But
yeah, that's infantilizing too.
Yeah. So because we complained about all that, because people complained about all that, we ended up with Michael Bloomberg. It's our fault that Michael Bloomberg has decided to basically try to buy an election. So
yeah, what victim blaming?
Yeah, who they should really be upset with is the Democratic Party for opening their arms to this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the worst.
That's
so
obvious. But these people don't know how to blame powerful elites. Those people are their heroes,
right.
So they have to blame the riffraff and the actual resistance, which they like to claim to be part of.
Right.
The resistance to them is just like boycotting Nordstrom's because they carry Ivanka Trump's line. That's true. Jen Palmieri recommended that.
Very, very heavy politics right there.
No, she said that don't think that the anger with Trump is about Fight for 15. It's about boycotting Nordstrom's. She said that to Chuck Todd.
Very,
I love
very,
Chuck
I mean,
Todd.
Look, that's the things like that can change the entire world. You never
know. Yeah,
game changers. So I have an idea.
Yeah.
I think as a ritualistic thing that we can all experience together, I think every time Amy Klobuchar tells her snow woman joke on television, I think we have to just ceremonially listen to it together.
Oh, God.
Listen to the whole thing. And
get
our audience members to also listen to it.
Okay.
So this is a shared experience.
Right.
This is in public speaking. They tell you at the beginning of a speech to invoke a shared experience with the audience.
Okay.
So let's share this experience of listening to this
Got
joke
it.
Again.
Okay, great.
All right, so she did it at her town hall.
And be aggressive, of course. But I also think you've got to point out how absurd he is at times, right?
Absurd.
You do, and you have to be nimble. You have to be nimble in the moment to be able to do that. So when I announced my candidacy in the middle of that blizzard, and he made fun of me for talking about climate change in a blizzard and called me Snow Woman, which I kind of liked, actually. I sent out a tweet and said, the science is on my side, Donald Trump, when it comes to climate change, and I'd like to see how your hair would fare in a blizzard.
Woo! I like the way she says you have to be nimble.
Yeah.
As if repeating the same. I mean, there's nothing wrong with repeating the same joke again and again and again.
She's nimbly repeating the same joke over and over again.
What's nimble about it?
So where's your pain level with listening to this joke right now on a scale of 1 to 10?
It's not that bad because
I'm like at a 4 right now.
Yeah. With 10 being the most painful?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say it's a 4, and like Warren saying like, I think you just called me a liar. That's like an 8.
That's an 8?
Yeah.
Do you think we can get our audience members up to an 8 or 9 with this joke? Do you think we'll have time to do that?
I don't know. You know what reminds me of when you said it has to be a shared experience?
Shared experience, yeah.
And it's like a painful experience. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's the Chris Hedges book, War is a Force That Brings Us Together?
Right, yes.
It's like this joke is a force.
This is a joke that is a force that's going to bring us all together. Yeah. We're going to share in the agony of this experience. So, okay. So we have stone moments for this week. We have a whole bunch of them that are crazy.
Yeah. So here's an interesting moment that Jack Allison found, co-host of the Struggle Session podcast, Bloomberg.
I'll tell you where I'm going. First, Iowa, then New Hampshire.
Jesus.
So how do we explain that to people who are just listening?
So it's basically Mike Dukakis. It's Mike Bloomberg doing Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And he's on a string and he's floating around an umbrella that has NYPD and Mets logos on it.
Yeah.
And he's saying that he's going to, you know, let's see if we can get the country to behave better. And then he kind of flies across the stage, Peter Pan style. And then he flies across the stage
with an umbrella and a briefcase that says MP on it.
At the end, I find myself wanting to drop him in a tank full of Komodo dragons at the end, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's just so horrible.
It's really weird, though, because like the curtain descends over him in a kind of ominous way.
That is a genuinely horrifying clip. If he actually becomes president, I think that I'm emotionally scarred already having watched that. So
yeah, what's your pain level on that?
That's more like a 7 already.
Oh, 7, okay.
Yeah, because I can already see him floating to power.
Can we hear the very beginning again? I just want to hear what he says.
I'll tell you where I'm going. First, Iowa, then New Hampshire.
It's so Waiting for Guffman, by the way.
Totally.
I'll tell you where I'm going.
Yeah, the
going.
Delivery is amazing.
Yeah.
No, I actually don't recommend that anyone get high and watch that. I think that would not be a happy experience.
Yeah.
So, what else we have? We got Biden.
We got a Biden moment, yeah.
But the obligatory.
Of course, yeah.
Biden moment. We're going to miss him when he's not in the race.
I know. Don't even mention it. I don't want to think. We're not there yet, so.
Joe Biden. Yeah, yeah. Joe Biden. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a Backstreet Boys song. I don't know
is
if
it?
You know. It's like, everybody, rock your body, everybody, Backstreet's back. All right. I almost admire it. It's almost like a cult. Reminds me of a cult movie or something.
Right.
Like, it's such a weird throwback.
It's Aum Shinrikyo, but with Biden as the cult leader.
Yeah, it's like a weird 90s song. I mean, 90s song to refer to. I'm not sure why. Is it from the aughts or the 90s?
My favorite is the look on his face where he's just like,
where am I and who are these people?
Well, How did I get here?
Yeah, and he's like, they're good. It's kind of on brand, though, because remember he mentioned a movie from like the 50s?
Yeah.
So they're mentioning a song from the 90s. It's just like a weird, they're cultural
cross purposes.
Yeah, they're cultural cross purposes. And neither is like, they're not very present to the moment right now.
I just don't get the enthusiasm.
Like, and where's he back from?
I could see voting for Joe Biden. Like, I could actually imagine myself making that decision. I mean, I wouldn't. But I can see someone talking themselves into that. But excitement. That's something I don't
really? I think he's so funny, though.
You think he's funny?
Yeah. He cracks me up. But I guess that's, I wouldn't be working for him, though.
He's like your funny uncle?
Yeah. But no, yeah, I don't know what they're excited about.
This is definitely weird. That's a deeply disturbing moment as well. So.
Yeah.
All right. What else we got? We have
God.
Oh, this is good. I like this. Pete.
And shout out to Leslie Lee's really funny tweet. Leslie Lee, also co-host of Struggle Session, goes, there's someone whose job it is to train white politicians to sound like Obama. They were hired by John Ossoff and now Buttigieg. Okay.
This is Pete at the Nevada Black Legislative Caucus. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Nevada Black Caucus. Thank you so much for having me with you.
He's kind of nervous.
To Chair Monroe Moreno, thank you for your leadership. So honored to be joined with Speaker Frierson, with Chair McCurdy, with my longtime friend, Attorney General Ford, and everyone here who is making history with the historic diversity in the majority women assembly right here in Nevada. We are watching you from around the country, and we are proud of you.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly imitating Obama here.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's kind of like one of those, like an alien parasite. He like takes on the characteristics of all the people around, like a zealot. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So he's trying to do, I guess this is what his brain is telling him to do in front of a black audience, which is
sound like Obama.
Yeah, exactly.
But put on my best
it kind of came out of his head too fast.
Oh my
beginning.
God. Can we just watch the very beginning once more?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Black Caucus. Thank you so much for having me with you.
Why is it so funny? It really is.
Good afternoon.
He's so smooth.
If we ran for president, we'd be
okay,
up.
But we're not. And if we did, they have the right to make fun of us.
That's
for that.
True. That's a good one. I like
that.
Yeah,
it's good, right?
Yep. All right. What else we got?
Oh, this is a really scary Bloomberg thing. This is from friend of the show, Max Blumenthal, guest of the show, who tweeted that there's this weird footage of bizarre and revealing footage of Mike Bloomberg halting a press conference for over a minute to stare down and humiliate a disabled reporter in a wheelchair whose audio device accidentally went off. So watch this.
For workers' rights, or immigrant rights, and for gay rights. If we can turn off the...
Mayor, that's like your theme.
Okay. I'm ninja, but can we... Is it, something's playing? Can we just stop this and maybe we'll start again?
Look at the guy behind him, like, gawking.
Okay. I understand that. Still turn it off.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's a little bit too important for playing music.
Playing music.
We start again as soon as we can do this.
So
he got
are you looking
out
forward
for
to the Mike Bloomberg presidency?
So much.
He's so condescending to everybody. It's unbelievable. And he doesn't even disguise it.
Isn't he a terrible boss? And he has like open an open office plan and yells at people all the time.
I don't know. But I believe that story. I like that story.
Yeah.
I hope it's true. This is not a good dude.
And this is like a great metaphor for like, he's like kind of Trump light in some ways because of course Trump made fun of. Yeah. He's like a more polite.
Trump did a Borscht Belt.
Yeah. More offensive impersonation of a disabled reporter. And this is like the kindler, gentler.
Well, this is Bloomberg's thing is to bristle. He bristles. Right. And he's just evincing displeasure with people. That's like his whole campaign slogan is like, I am evincing displeasure at the ineffectiveness of everybody.
But I eat big gay ice cream.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So vote for me. God, what a jerk. Right.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And then this is what we're going to have to get used to for the next.
Wow. I can't believe I never heard you so earnest about someone.
Really?
God, what a jerk. Yeah.
I can't stand this guy.
How come? I mean, I can't either, but I'm just curious.
This guy, to me, represents everything that sucks about this country. You know, he is a completely entitled, you know, he thinks because he made a lot of money in a basically a semi-failure-proof business that he invented the wheel, that he's a genius. He's actually just, you know, a guy who made a ton of money, but that doesn't make him a good person.
Right.
Doesn't make him effective in anything, but he's completely convinced of his own amazingness. He thinks that everybody... should buy into him as much as he buys into himself. He has an obviously dismissive attitude towards everybody else, and he thinks that we should reward him for that attitude. That's the thing that's amazing about this guy. He goes into politics and he's used to being told how great he is, and he thinks that this formula should be repeated nationally. And it will be so annoying if his views about everything are validated, by this crazy set of circumstances. And I don't know.
Called the Democratic Party being awful and totally enabling him and coddling him. Yeah. Well, you know, an interesting point, Matt, is that I don't usually agree with this person, but I got it. Let's play an interesting insight. Some interesting points made by Meghan McCain, because she kind of has some good things to say about the problem with Bloomberg. And the other women of The View sound like, they're often idiotic, but here they just sound like Meghan McCain is a voice of reason, which is rare. Okay.
First of all, that's 2011 on PBS. That's not something he said after a few drinks, like at dinner privately.
Exactly.
That's something he said on air. So but where there's smoke, there's just one second.
Yeah.
He also there's a lawsuit the Washington Post dug up where he was sued for saying there was a woman who was having trouble finding a nanny for her child, and he said it's a blanking baby. It doesn't know the difference between you and anyone else. All you need is some black who doesn't even have to speak English to rescue it from a burning building.
You know, all I have to say.
But I'm just saying, you want to go up against Trump and you want to take the moral high ground, Democrats. I don't know if this guy is going to be the one.
I have to say, there are very fine people on both sides. That was in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
He said that removing Confederate monuments was trying to take away our culture.
But you want to take the moral high ground.
Belittled the Black Lives Movement. He questioned whether Barack Obama.
I'm not defending Trump because I'm attacking
Bloomberg. Well, what are you saying then? Who are you going to vote for?
I'm saying that you're shiny, sparkly. I'm saying
you're
shiny, sparkly guy who's surging right now, which, by the way, everybody surges in primary politics.
Well, yeah, I
remember when Gingrich did and Herman Cain did. Every candidate surges at one point or another.
He still thinks that Central Park Five is guilty.
Because he's a sparkly little. Because you know what? I just think it's so interesting that you have a problem that we are talking about a candidate the way we would any other candidate. He just happens to be at the top getting the attention right now, which is why we're talking about it right now. What, I'm supposed to give Bloomberg a pass? Not on this show, not with this host.
I'd like to know who you're going to vote for.
Well,
who are you voting for?
Who I vote for is none of your business, but I am not voting for Trump, and I'm sure as hell not voting for Bloomberg.
So then you're not going to vote.
Okay?
Yeah. So you're
none of your business.
So you're not voting for Trump, and you're not voting for a Democrat.
Who I vote for?
That is, she literally deduces that because Meghan McCain says she's not going to vote for Trump or Bloomberg, she's not going to vote.
Right.
Yeah. What does she know that we don't?
Well, I don't know. Right. Yeah, exactly. And
Bloomberg is definitely going
to
win.
It's also so transparent. The only answer they have to this guy sucks is, well, Trump is bad.
Oh, well, that's right. That's just the bigger thing. It's like literally that's how they think. Like Joy Behar, her response to, because what's interesting is Meghan McCain is making a moral and strategic argument. Like when we talked with Roe Khanna and I made the wonderful point about politics and policy. I really blew him away.
Yeah, that was
really
amazing.
Really blew me away. Really blew Matt away. No, but I'm being serious. Like, she is saying that it's bad. It's a bad move for the Democrats to run as the moral high ground party when
against Trump. When
against
you have
Trump
a guy
with
a
someone
history
who
of
is
statements.
Has, yeah, who is, and so and Joy Behar's response is just reminding us how much worse Trump is. That's not really the most like winning message.
Also, people are so tired of that. They're so tired of every time you say anything about anything. Oh, Trump this, Trump that.
Right, exactly.
Who cares? You know, the guy sucks. Can you find somebody who doesn't suck?
Well, you know, what's interesting is it's kind of a parallel or this is part of the same thing with what we saw with John Favreau saying like, you know, it's because you criticize Buttigieg and Klobuchar. Now it's that much harder to be taken seriously when we criticize Bloomberg. It's like, no, you don't get to just not criticize someone because someone else is bad.
Right.
Like Buttigieg is not good because Michael Bloomberg is worse. And Bloomberg is not good because Trump is worse.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the whole equation that the entire like Democratic Party establishment is based on. Trump is bad, therefore X is whatever. Like, that's the whole formula.
The
it just doesn't
colon
work.
Better than Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. Behar was like amazing to watch this liberal brainworms. Like, she just can't understand why her next quote of Trump. She keeps naming things. She keeps saying things that he said. She doesn't understand why that doesn't take away from Meghan McCain's point.
Yeah, and you can see the gears are like,
yeah,
like they will not go to the next stop.
And
like,
she can also.
And they're all sitting there on the air, like they're brains are all frozen.
Yeah, and they're frozen on Bloomberg. If you're not going to vote for Bloomberg or Trump, I guess you're sitting this election out.
Right, yeah, exactly. Not a stone moment, but a...
Not a stone moment, but it was both a good... I like it as a segue out of the stone moments, but also I felt stoned watching it because I was like, wait, why do I agree with Meghan McCain? That's weird.
That's true. All right, let's talk to Crystal and Sagar.
Let's do it. So we are so excited to be talking to Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty, who are the co-hosts of The Hill's Rising.
Welcome.
And co-authors of the book, A Populist Guide to 2020.
Which got how high?
I think it was number 5 in new releases, so not too shabby,
not
I'd
bad.
Say.
Wow.
Congratulations. That's fantastic. Yeah. So you've been on tour? You've been doing all that?
A very abbreviated short tour. We were out in L.A. We're getting ready to come to New York on March 6th. We've got a D.C.
DC show April 24th, so we're excited.
Yep.
Well, the book is really cool. Let's talk about some of the themes in it. First of all, has anything that's happened in the race since you finished the book changed your perspective on anything that you've written? In other words, do you view things at all differently because of, you know, Bloomberg's entrance in the race, anything like that?
How does your support of Bloomberg change this?
Excellent question.
Yeah.
I mean, that really is the dynamic that couldn't have been foreseen in the book, I would say. Although the way that it's playing out is very consistent with some of the predictions that are made in the book. So, you know, certainly the sort of core rot of the Democratic establishment, the cravenness with which so many have thrown themselves at him, you know, discarding with any previously stated principles, all that is very much foreseen in the book, even if the specific character of Michael Bloomberg is not.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, with Bloomberg in particular, all he does is expose exactly what we talked about. He has manipulated all of the levers kind of within the party and within our economy in order to show how do you get $60 billion in this country? It's by selling out America, you know, to China for Chinese interests. It's about owning, being literally an oligarch and owning your own company. I actually wrote about one of the chapters in the book is about Bloomberg News and their decision in order to basically just not investigate Mike and how that affects the entire media market when everybody in DC in journalism wants to go work for Michael Bloomberg,
right?
Then how does that affect how they're going to cover the race? And this extends to everybody. This extends to Jeff Bezos and his ownership of the Washington Post. It's a structural flaw. And that's, I mean, all he does is really reveal what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, look, Facebook already changed their rules for him. Mm-hmm. Like, it tells you everything. Because not only do you have every journalist in this town in New York knows one day they may need a Bloomberg paycheck. Every political consultant now knows that they may need a Bloomberg paycheck. And all of these big corporate media companies are on the take with the ad dollars that he's injecting into the system. So it's like a total corruption writ large.
How did Facebook change the rules for him?
Oh, so, you know, he has this whole meme strategy that you've probably heard about. And so they weren't allowing basically political paid meme content. And they decided that coincidentally, when Michael Bloomberg decided he wanted to throw millions at this, that this was going to be something that they would embrace.
Were you surprised at all when they made the announcement or when it came out that they were going to have that sort of non-aggression policy within Bloomberg where they weren't going to go after, investigate him? I was kind of surprised by the reaction of journalists. I thought other people in the business would be more hostile to that decision and that there would have been more criticism, but there was almost none. I was very surprised. I guess it's because people are worried they might get a job, might need a job someday.
I mean, honestly, Trump was the only person who said anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why there wasn't more of a reaction because no one wants to ever agree with Trump.
Yeah, that's what happened, right?
What happened is that
the Trump campaign seized on this and they were like, okay, we're going to not credential Bloomberg News reporters. So then it became a story about Trump versus the free press and not a literal oligarch using a media company with his name on it in order to manipulate the news cycle. Like I said, it's a very bad thing that Bloomberg News is not investigating journalists. And what we're learning now, I mean, I covered this on our show today, is that Bloomberg News has quashed stories into Chinese government officials in order to maintain the core Bloomberg terminal business in China. So this has always been a cynical attempt by Bloomberg to advance his interests, his core business interests. It didn't even actually have that much to do with media. And I think, Matt, to your point, the reaction, it just tells you everything you need to know about how the rest of the media views all this.
Well, and you guys remember how much, you remember how much shit David Sirota got, who's a Bernie Sanders senior advisor, who's one of the most effective operatives, I think, out there. But there was this whole pseudo scandal about, oh, was he talking to the Sanders campaign while he was still doing journalism? Meanwhile, you have people who literally go straight from Bloomberg News right onto the Bloomberg campaign, and no one says anything about that. Kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, that's a more traditional career arc. For exactly. At least they consider that, right? So
yeah, it's a decorum thing.
But I also think it was what Bloomberg did. Like, if he was really going to be ethical about it, he should have just the only way to do it would be to tell his staff that they can write whatever they want about him, because it, as is, it puts his 2,700 employees in an incredibly difficult position, right? Because they all have to admit to muzzling themselves on behalf of their employers, which I don't know. I'm just surprised there wasn't more of a reaction.
That there wasn't. Well, I'm always surprised there isn't even the air of fairness or legitimacy,
right?
Like that they don't even make the gesture that they're going to do something in an ethical way. Right. I know they're not going to, but I'm always surprised that they announce it. Kind of like the theme of today's show is, people saying that elites need to have more power. I'm not surprised people think this. I'm just surprised that people say it out loud.
Yeah, in the book, you talk about the formula that the Democrats could be using to win, and you use Kentucky as an example. I mean, I think right now people are looking at Bloomberg and they're saying, this is how we have to win. We have to spend $60 billion. That's how you beat Trump. But there's another way that you delineate in the book. Could you talk a little bit about that and what do you think the example is?
Yeah, and I think this is part of where, part of the exploration of the book is where Sagar from the right and me from the left, like where there's overlap. And we both basically believe in putting economic populism at the center of campaigns, both as a moral issue, like those are the issues, Medicare for all, from my perspective, Green New Deal, like directly economic issues, union rights should be at the center of campaigns as a moral issue, but also as an electability issue. So in Kentucky, when, Democrats were in the middle of impeachment, and the story that came out from Kentucky at the national level was, oh, look, impeachment is working for us, right? It didn't scare people off in Kentucky. But having lived there and knowing the characters involved, I can tell you it is the polar opposite of that. That campaign was run explicitly on a pro-worker, pro-teacher, pro-labor message. And it was actually the Bevin campaign, the Republican, who was obsessing about what was happening in D.C. and talking about impeachment all the time. And voters rejected that entirely. And it wasn't just, Kentucky doesn't have, a massive suburban population where you can make up for the rural areas. So it wasn't just that white suburban women came out. It was also that Democrats were able to turn the tide back in coal country, in eastern Kentucky, in places that had been sort of historically Democratic, but had turned to Trump and turned to Republicans very much on the national level. And Kentucky Democrats were able to win some of those folks back and win some of those counties back by focusing on a unifying sort of economic first message.
Yeah.
So I think that's really the core of my political philosophy in general. And like I said, it's not just about winning. Right. Because I think for a long time, Democrats have just been obsessed with winning. And that leads to things like Michael Bloomberg, right? Where you're like, if all I care about is winning, and we're constantly told that the way to win is to get the most right wing person you can find, then you end up with Michael Bloomberg. And not only is it a disaster on a moral level, but you end up ultimately losing, too. His politics are the polar opposite of what I think winning politics look like in this country. Aggressively, socially, culturally liberal, and economic, complete corporatist, right? Oligarch, corporatist, etc. Very condescending, full of contempt for most of the country. That is, to me, the antithesis of how Democrats should be running.
The interesting thing, you talk about the overlap between what Sagar, what you think of from the right, and Crystal, you from the left, you both have frustrations with sort of modern identity politics. Can you talk about what you both think the failings are there and why it's not necessarily a successful strategy for Democrats?
Yeah, and I think that's what Crystal was just talking about. And it's funny because of so much of what I think the most successful Republican governorship and campaign in America right now is explicitly run on a pro-worker message. If you think about this, it's Ron DeSantis in Florida. He's got a 74% approval rating, and he did it by appropriating money in order to save the Everglades. He did it by declaring this year, 2020, to be the year of the teacher. He did it by pairing all of that, an economic populist message, with immigration restriction, which is something where we depart. But I think that that is what a key area to me that shows how you can actually govern in an economically populist way that is not built on white identity politics or, from the left perspective, identity politics writ large. The one thing that cuts across all identity is class. And it's funny because that's really what the Bloomberg candidacy has showed us, and it's an explicit affirmation of class divide and class politics when you see young black people supporting Bernie Sanders, middle-class suburban black people or older voters with more middle-class interests supporting a Michael Bloomberg or Joe Biden. That has nothing to do with race record. It actually has much more to do with how they look at their class interests. And that's actually, I think, an inspiring message to both of us, because how else can you live in a multi-ethnic, like non-homogenous country of 300 million people? The only way to do it is to focus on working class interests. And it's much more about, the book is just about, what if the right and the left fought about the interests of the workers instead of the interests of plutocrats?
Right. Right now, as you all know, there is a bipartisan consensus in Washington. Like, the idea that there's gridlock is actually a fantasy. There's plenty of bipartisan consensus when it comes to sending young working class men and women off to die in war, right? There's plenty of bipartisan consensus. Just look just this year on new trade deals. That's always there. There's always bipartisan consensus to cut rich people's taxes more through loopholes and giveaways and whatever. So rather than both the parties fighting over who can most cater to the wealthy, which I believe is the situation we have today, what if they both were fighting over who could actually win the working class? You know, on identity specifically, it's not that I don't think racism exists, sexism is real, like bigotry is a real thing. Like, let's be clear about that. But substituting a trailblazing identity for actual change is so much less than what this country needs.
Yeah.
So, you know, and part of the political analysis too, part of why the pundits have been so consistently wrong this election cycle is because they assume that voters vote on identity when they really don't. I mean, you'll remember at the beginning of this race, we were told Kamala Harris was going to be the one. And I specifically read like the CNN analysis, Chris Saliza and Harry Enten said that it was, you know, her trailblazing identity was going to resonate with black voters. And that was the key base. And that's why she was going to succeed. But it turned out that's not how voters thought about this at all. They looked at her platform. They looked at the fact that she didn't know, seem to know what she wanted to fight for. It was just sort of standard issue neoliberalism. And they said, thank you, next. And that wasn't white voters that rejected her. That was primarily minority voters in the party who said, this is not actually what we're after.
In a related chapter, Crystal, you talked about why Pete Buttigieg fell flat with millennials, right? It was a similar situation. They said, oh, he's young and he's gay, so of course millennials are going to like him. It was a total non sequitur logically. But what do you think happened there?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, and you guys have probably been involved in these ventures, like media ventures, where they want to appeal to millennials. So they hire like a millennial correspondent and they say the word millennial a lot. And it's always like boomers who set this up, and it always gets lots of funding and then completely fails. I mean, Pete is exactly what a boomer thinks a young person should want, but he doesn't threaten their own sort of class interests, right? So they can feel good about, oh, he's trailblazing, he's gay, he's young, he's a fresh face. They can feel good about this is a voice of change, but not actually threaten their own bottom line interests. Meanwhile, people, I mean, I'm almost exactly the same age as Pete. We're like 2 months apart, born 2 months apart. And so people who are his contemporaries, we know who he is. Like, we went to college with this dude, right? We see exactly who he is. The careerism, the ambition, the willingness to change your values, however it suits you at that moment. And also the willingness to uncritically participate at McKinsey in an industry that basically was designed to sell out the working class in this country, which is what so many of the quote unquote best and brightest minds of our generation were told that we should do. Whether it was McKinsey or Wall Street, right? Everybody I went to school with at UVA wanted to be like an investment banker, right? That was the thing. And so the fact that he went there is less of a problem to me than the fact that he has no critical analysis of that system and the problems inherent in it.
Crystal, and Matt, you, the three of us will often get kind of like criticized as being Trumpian, the Trumpian left. They will try to taint us. And I'm sure they do that with you because of your association with, among other people, Sagar. But Sagar, I was curious if you get that from the right. Like, do people try to taint you as like Sandersian or something, or like a Marxist because of your work with Crystal? And
Katie, I get it all the time. They think, they call me the chief Bernie bro correspondent of the right. I get it constantly for my associates. They're like, why don't you call out these Venezuela loving dog eating socialists on their show? And I'm like, well, you know, if you want to run on that, you can be my guest and you can lose and we can all have a Mitt Romney campaign in 2012 all over again. Yes, I get a lot of criticism. So does Tucker Carlson. I think a lot of it is that they call us, like, they basically say that we're progressives in a sheep's clothing and that any concession of using government power is a concession to the left because it will inevitably get taken over and then we'll all, you know, all of our freedoms will go away. And again, they have no response every single time. I said, what if you know, take this hat off and you consider for a second that corporate power over your life is just as detrimental as government power? They don't even have like the mental framework to process that. And so a lot of what I do on the show is just try to break through that mold. But yeah, certainly there's a lot of, you know, people on the Trump campaign are not particularly happy with me because I'm like, what are you guys doing running this socialism sucks banners at every single debate? Like a lot of people on the right, especially with the Trump phenomenon, is they demand like total fealty to the, you know, to make America great again, like Trump himself. Whereas like I look at it, and I think a lot of other economic populists on the right are very much have a fealty to that message, and you're willing to call out anybody who strays away from it. And so that's really what the dynamics are. But you are very right, Katie. I take a lot of incoming fire on this.
Well, people get, and yeah. I shouldn't say, yeah. Because I think our show, like the people who watch our show, which has grown really quickly and there's been a big response to, like, I think most people actually do understand our politics because it's the politics of like 70% of America.
Yes, right.
You know, 70% of America is completely disgusted with everyone here in this town in DC, right? So they can wrap their head around it no problem. But what you see, and you see this, like Glenn Greenwald is the perfect example. The fact that he actually has principles, or Tulsi Gabbard is another great example. The fact that he actually has principles that he's consistent with across administrations, not just like when it serves his own party interests, people here can't understand that. Like they can't wrap their head around it. They think there must be something like nefarious going on. Who's paying him, right? What are his motives, etc. And it's like, no, actually, he called out W. Bush when that was the guy who was messing up and going against his principles. He called out Obama. He calls out Trump. He calls out the left. He calls out, you know, Bolsonaro in Brazil. The guy just actually is consistent. And it's so unusual and rare in this town that it blows people's minds.
Doesn't your show also, it explodes a huge stereotype in the media, which is that left and right cannot communicate rationally. I mean, there just is not a media show, and there hasn't been for decades, where the premise was like yours. If Republicans and Democrats were on the same set, they had to be ferociously arguing all the time, like in Crossfire. Do you ever talk to people within the industry about, do people doubt that this format would work? And are they surprised at how much of a response you're getting?
I mean, people in the industry just don't understand the show. They only recently woke up to it, which is like when the book hit the Amazon top 10, they were like, whoa, something is going on here. That's basically, honestly, what made people even start to pay attention. They don't, yeah, Matt, they think that right and left can only coexist in a Morning Joe framework where it turns out everybody's just neoliberal. Or they think that it has to be a CNN panel where people are screaming at each other over whether Trump should be impeached or not, or talking about Roger Stone or Paul Manafort's case. No, what we did is we just went a level deeper than cable news and then tried to take a shared analysis and then look at it from different, I mean, this is the funny thing. Whenever people come on our show, they love the types of questions that we ask because we don't ask any of the simple cable answers that are designed to get the exact response that the host knows that he's going to get, so they can have a weird sparring conversation for a 2-minute bite, and that will go viral amongst media reporters. Instead, we're actually just, whenever I have Bernie people on my show, I don't necessarily agree with them all the time. I'm just like, hey, here's some good faith criticism that I've heard. What is your response?
Yeah, I think that's been the other interesting thing is we try to have a range of voices on, like genuine range of voices from the populist left, from the populist right, and from the more establishment-minded framework. And I even personally wasn't sure if that would work, right? Because there is a lot of interest in like just cheerleading for our side and seeing our perspective and all of that. So to me, it's been a very hopeful thing. One of the things that our fans tell us all the time is that that's part of what they love about the show, is that you can see that debate happening in real time where, you know, people with a more pro-establishment view are actually getting challenged and having to engage in a back and forth and having to even like concede some points in certain cases. And same goes our way as well. So to me, that response has been a very hopeful part of doing this whole show. Yeah, and it's been also surprising, like, we have a lot of leftists who watch the show. We have a lot of people on the populist right. But we also have like just a lot of, you know, kind of normal politically engaged folks who have had their minds changed by some of the perspectives on the show, who have reached out to us and said, you know, I was going in this direction and now I see things differently. It really has had a broad sort of base of support that has surprised me.
Another thing that I love about the show is that you are just honest about your perspectives. I mean, I think that like one of the biggest dangers in the media is the pseudo objectivity. So when people watch you, just like if they watch us, they know where we're coming from more or less. And with you guys, of course.
They know that we have that like fundamental pro Bloomberg framework.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, you recently, and it's also interesting how I can talk to you, obviously, Crystal, but you, Sagar, like you are honest about the Bernie bias in a way that some of my liberal friends with whom I agree on certain things that I disagree with you are not. It's just like you, like there's a good faith, I feel like, a view and discussion.
Katie, the reason why is, and Matt will intimately understand this from his media criticism, is the same frameworks of which they are biased against Bernie is the same frameworks unless there's their bias against Republicans, is the same framework against their bias against Trump. A lot of it is just, it's biased toward not an anti-Bernie, pro-Clinton end, it's biased toward a pro-corporate neoliberal lens. And anybody who attacks that is somebody that has to be destroyed. That's why I call it out, because this exact same structural forces that keep Bernie out of the media and have basically crushed him, or have tried to crush him and it shows to be not working, are the same thing that they did to Republicans in 2016, the same things that they do to people who are populist and on the right. So I have you have a real responsibility, like Crystal was talking about with Glenn Greenwald, is to remain consistent so that people know that when you're calling out one thing that is helpful to your side, that it's not because you have just a partisan personal interest. It's to call it out whenever you see it.
Yeah. You know, I do want to say that you guys and all the guests that we have on the show have really like educated and informed us and informed the book. I mean, Matt, we reference Hate Inc. multiple times in the book. Your thoughts on media criticism have been very, very influential with, I think, both of us.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we're really grateful for the input that you guys provide there as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, your show has been it's been so cool to watch it grow. And,
yeah.
I think one of the things that people are responding to, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, your show is a lot about where the intersection between right and left happens, right? And one of the big ones is just frustration with the media, isn't it? I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why you're getting such a big audience, is because people from both sides are kind of they're frustrated. They feel like they're being lied to or manipulated, and that's why they're looking for this new kind of voice.
I mean, did you all see that moment on MSNBC on the day of the New Hampshire primary? When, you know, Ari Melber is there, my former co-host, by the way, who's interviewing voters about who they're voting for and why. And this woman basically grabs the mic and is like, I want you to know why I'm voting for Bernie Sanders. And it's because you and your colleagues are so biased against him and smear him so consistently that I was on the fence and I was like, you know what? I'm voting for Bernie. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing her, but that was basically the message.
Yeah.
And what is incredible about 2016 and no lessons were learned, obviously. And what we see playing out now is they didn't even give Bernie Sanders a shot until like a week ago, right? And they're still like, well, maybe Pete is the real front runner, right? Or, you know, maybe Bloomberg is the real thing that's going to happen here. And meanwhile, people have made up their own minds. It just exposes how sort of fragile and hollow and, you know, ineffective and impotent all of these supposed gatekeepers are at this point. Yeah. How many essays have we seen about how Bernie's unelectable? You will certainly lose with Bernie, right? David Frum had his thing, the Bulwark had their thing, and Jonathan Chait, like all of them come out with it. And what happens? Bernie surges in terms of electability specifically, where he now leads the field in electability. Like, people looked at that and they said, no, forget it. You're wrong. You've been wrong about everything else, and you're wrong about this, too.
Yeah, like, thank you to David Frum for, you know, giving your record on the Iraq War. Everything you say is like, you're endorsing Bernie, basically, because your record is so bad in terms of your predictions. But yeah, what was amazing is that, and it's so funny, because that literally was coming right into my head when you brought that example up. What's amazing is, I don't know if you saw this, but the woman who...
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
She says that she was considering not just Warren, which isn't that surprising, but she was considering Michael Bennett. So the fact that you have someone who's not a raging leftist, but who's just a cognizant, aware, non-comatose person, can just see how unfair MSNBC is towards Sanders. And she said that they were so cynical in the way that they were saying, like, last time he was doing a lot better because he was running against one person versus multiple people. Like, this is just a basic question of math. Yeah, I thought that was just incredible. And, you know, like, the Bernie bro narrative thing drives me crazy, as you guys are well aware. And I was thinking, like, aren't the real bros, like, they're bros, and every candidate has toxic supporters, quote-unquote toxic. And an issue is no one defines any of these terms, what toxic is, what harassment is, the difference between harassment and, like, political analysis education and criticism. But Bernie's the only person who has to deal with those attacks on him and his supporters, and the anti-Semitic attacks against him and the racist attacks against his people who work for him. And then he has the bros of, like, MSNBC. Like, those are they're bullies, too. Like, Chuck Todd calling his supporters brown shirts, or Joanne Reed getting a body language.
Yeah, well, Crystal, you wrote a chapter about this in the book. I mean, what did MSNBC, how much damage do you think that they did, and how did they do it? I mean, you wrote a whole chapter about this. Explain a little bit. You obviously have personal experience there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think the fact that they decided what they wanted to make their consistent hour after hour, segment after segment editorial focus on was Russiagate did a dramatic disservice to the left and has ultimately put Trump in an incredibly strong position to win re-election, which he doesn't deserve, right? So the fact that they fixated on this elite concern, which essentially turned out to mostly be conspiracy theory, and we're not talking about a few segments during the day, as you guys know, this was relentless. Every segment, every hour, the highest rated programs. And they led this, you know, liberal audience down the garden path, constantly promising when the next shoe would drop, that would be the thing. Then the walls would close in. Then the walls would close in. And now, even after impeachment, now people are starting to say, maybe we should impeach him again, right? Maybe then that would be the thing. By focusing on that instead of the very real broken promises made to working class people, making the case about now he's floating, you know, now in his budget, he wants to cut Social Security, right? Putting entitlements on the table, giving a massive tax cut to the rich. These are antithetical to what he said he would do in office. But rather than prosecuting that economic case, they've focused on elite concerns that literally no real person actually cares, like no persuadable person cares about.
How do you see this playing out? I mean, this whole scenario has been so unusual. With there's the field is too big. Bloomberg has jumped in. It looks like Bloomberg, in a weird way, is helping Sanders by jumping in late. He's going to take votes away from people who are challenging Sanders early in the race. How do you see it playing out? And Do you think that, that Sanders is actually going to end up with enough votes to win in the first ballot?
I'll let Krista go first.
So Sagar and I have a little bit of a difference of opinion on this. I think that ultimately the Democratic establishment is a bunch of cowards. So even though they will want to steal it from Bernie, and I think he's very much on track to get a plurality of the delegates. I don't know if he's on track to get a majority of the delegates. He could be. I think that they will be too afraid. And this is where actually the Bernie bros turn into a positive thing, because they know those people are crazy and they know they will burn the party down if they steal it from Bernie. I mean, that is their feeling about it, right? If you take the nomination from Bernie when he wins a plurality of the delegates and you hand it to Michael Bloomberg, there is a very large chunk of the Bernie base that are not going to vote blue no matter who. And so I think ultimately they will realize that it will utterly destroy the Democratic Party, and they will be too afraid and too unable to get their shit together to actually pull that off. So Sagar's not so sure.
Yeah, Sagar doesn't agree, I take it. Yeah,
I'm much more cynical. I think the Democratic establishment, I wish they were as much cowards as Crystal says, because I think the Republicans are actually much bigger cowards. But whenever it comes to this, if you see the sheer amount of money that is at risk with Bernie, I just don't see how these establishment stooges will allow it to happen if they have the chance. I really think there is an opportunity. Look, if Michael Bloomberg gets 30% and he picks somebody, this is my new obsession. I think he's going to pick Stacey Abrams because she checks all the boxes, allegedly progressive, on the team because she took $5 million of her organization money, woman of color, you know, ascendant star within the party, had the response to Trump. If Bloomberg does that on the second ballot, can realistically make a case that he's got a progressive woman of color with his money that they could win. He's 79 years old. She could take that chance. That's a ticket that they could absolutely get behind, and it preserves their economic interests. I don't know what will happen, but I think they're certainly going to try. They didn't even try with Trump. That's the one thing to remember, is that they were so afraid of Trump supporters and all of that, that they just decided not to even do it. They quashed it before the convention. And when you have the opportunity, if Trump did not have, by the way, the majority of the delegates going into that convention, 100%, I know this for a fact, they would have tried it.
Yeah.
Would it have succeeded? I don't know. But they would have tried it. So Sanders is in that position, and I'm just deeply more cynical, because I understand the structural forces that are at work here. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that are on the line. That's one thing Wall Street has learned from all of this, is that with the presidency, with the ascendant of executive orders and of populism and all of that, is literally 75 years of your investments are at risk. Are they really going to let all their down payments through philanthropy just, you know, go to waste when they have the chance? Well, I don't think so.
And that is, I mean, this is where I do go back and forth. Yeah. Because on the other hand, look, the reality is that a Sanders administration is much more of a threat to their continued both access to power and big flow and ascendancy in this town than a Trump administration. Like, Trump wins 4 more years. All right, you try again with another neoliberal in 4 years and you got another go at it. You get to maintain your status. You get to get your gigs from the DNC. All of that remains basically in place. You're just in the opposition, which is, you know, a situation they're familiar with. What they are not familiar with is a guy who says, no, 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 we're not doing any of that anymore. All of you people are, you know, in exile. We don't want this part of the party anymore. That is a much more of a danger to their ultimate sort of interest than a Trump reelect. So that's where I go back and forth. But I do err on the side of believing that they are too cowardly to actually.
Well, we have to make it so that they're embarrassed. Like, we have to make it so that they'll be afraid to pull it off. I don't know how to do that, but.
Yeah, I'm with Sagar on this one. I think there's too much at stake. I think they'll.
Can you guys?
I mean, and also, they can argue that they won't even be breaking the rules if he doesn't get enough to win on the first ballot. They can argue that's how the party is designed. So
right, Matt, that's the thing. Barney Frank is on the chairman of these committees, right? Like, Tom Perez has basically stacked it with people. I mean, I think Barney Frank literally works for a bank right now. But it's like these are the people. It's just there's too much money at risk, and the left runs DC. Every single building here is a professional union or is against Medicare for All because they struck these deals, or it's like a think tank which is funded with all this money. I mean, these are the people who have so much invested in the current process They can't let it go down without a fight if they have the chance. Their donors won't let them, by the way. With Trump, at least he had the majority of the delegates. If he doesn't have the majority, they're going to fight. Whether it works or not, I don't know, but they have to.
All right. In a theoretical universe where Sanders does win the nomination, how is that going to be covered? In other words, are we actually going to see channels like MSNBC and CNN breaking against Sanders? What will actually happen in that universe? I actually don't know the answer to that
question. Will they be throwing up in their mouths?
I really don't know, because they've spent so much time saying Trump is, you know, the greatest danger to American democracy.
Right. They are all the way in on that
narrative. And meanwhile, look, they're at odds with their, you know, with their customer base, because while there is a sliver of the Democratic primary electorate that doesn't like Sanders, he's consistently rated the most favorable, you know, among all the candidates. So their own viewers like Bernie and don't have like a major issue with him. So I think it would be hard for them to then just like flip and either become neutral or like sort of, you know, suddenly see the good side in Trump. I think their ratings will be very bad.
I think they'll be
in a really tough spot, basically.
I think they'll have a very tough time. And I ultimately think Crystal's right. Their ratings are going to plummet, mostly because they have not prepared their viewers for this race. And they have not prepared themselves for this race. They don't have the right analysts to actually accurately tell them what the dynamics of the race are. And that is why, I mean, that's why I think our show is going to do really well. That's why I think your show is going to do really well. Because we've been tracking this from the beginning. If we have the right frameworks to understand how Sanders and a Trump race actually would go, whereas they're going to focus on just the stupidest, most astroturfed thing and miss the broader story of how most of the country wants to burn our institutions to the ground. When you don't even understand that, you're not capable of understanding that race.
Yeah.
I think Sagar, in the book, you make a really good point at one point where you talk about how Trump won by running against free market orthodoxy, right? Which is an observation that it's so obvious and simple, you can't even see it anywhere on television because it runs counter to what people believe about what happened in 2016.
Which is also dangerous, because the people who most hate Trump and who will never make that argument, it's irresponsible to not look at how he won. Like, if you want to defeat him, you have to be honest about how he won.
Yeah, there hasn't really been. I mean, has there been a real forensic analysis actually? I don't know. It's an interesting
point. Here's my prediction, though, about what MSNBC will do if Bernie does win. They'll do what they're already doing sometimes, which Joanne Reed does this a lot. They'll talk about what the media could say about him, or Chuck Todd does this. Like, they're afraid that he will be red-baited. They don't use that word, but they're afraid that his, you know, siding against the Contras will hurt him. Which is, they just basically say the media critique that they pretend to outsource it, but they're actually articulating it, and they're pretending that this is a vulnerability, but they're doing the arguing that they're bemoaning or lamenting is going to happen. Like, they're like, I just don't want to see him being accused of being a raging communist, but that'll happen. And they, in the process, have just accused him of being a raging communist. And then they're going to just compare Trump and Bernie and say how similar they are, and how the bros this and the extremists this. And well, of course, what anyone who takes politics seriously knows is that what makes Sanders electable is that he's, in some ways, there are parallels, but he's totally diverges. Like, that's what makes you electable. When you have, you don't want an excited, fervent base. You don't want that. How are you going to defeat Trump?
Well, and that's, you made such a good point, and this has been something I've been thinking about a lot. Part of why the left has been so ineffective at prosecuting the case against Donald Trump is because they never bothered to understand the real reasons why people like Trump and the real way that people felt about Trump. And if you don't understand the way that normal people are thinking about this leader, then you're not going to understand where the cracks are and what you should be hitting and going after. It's the same thing with Bernie, right? And you see this, like, since they are so bought into this narrative that nobody likes him, right? And that, you know, people see him as a secret sexist and whatever, they really thought the Elizabeth Warren attack on him was going to work.
Oh my God, that'd be amazing.
And it did nothing but backfire, right? Which we saw coming, because it was another sort of like hollow identity play that ultimately highlighted her own questions about her own electability, right? So the fact that they don't have an accurate picture of how most of the public sees him renders them incapable of actually mounting an effective attack against him.
Yeah, and let me say this too, which is, Katie, to your excellent point earlier about MSNBC and the socialism, but the communist. The funny thing is, the right takes its cues from that. So part of the issue is why I think it will be a very, very bad, very difficult for Trump with Sanders. I think it's a true toss-up, whereas I don't think it is that way with anywhere else, is that the RNC and all these other people have been wanting to run the Vera Socialist campaign for years. They said it about Obama. They said it about Clinton, even Bill Clinton, right? One of the most corporatist candidates of all time. They are foaming at the mouth in order to run that type of campaign. And so that, because it's a fundamentally neoliberal framework, and they don't understand the class differences. So to me, the big issue I have is that the right will only take its cues from these idiots on MSNBC and be like, yeah, see, every time we talk about this, it gets a lot of airtime, and regular people are just going to be out there and be like, I just want healthcare. I want my job back. That's it. That's literally, I mean, is that a crazy way to think about politics? No!
Sagar, though, do you think that the word socialist is going to be a real vulnerability for Sanders if he ends up in the general election? I mean, is there anything to that argument? I think there might be.
I you know, Matt, I really don't think so, because they said so much of the same about Trump. Oh, look at what do they say? That they compared his speeches to Mussolini line by line with the number of syllables.
Yeah.
I mean, do you guys remember this? It's like, oh, he's a fascist, he's the next Hitler. All of a sudden, it's people just completely tune it out. And that's why I think it's actually genius for Sanders just to be like, yeah, I'm a democratic socialist. Because then you're not even trying to be like, no, I'm not a fascist. You're just like, I am this label. This is what it means to me. That means to me, what it means to me is quite reasonable in the minds of many Americans. That's all you do. That's what I would do. And I think it's brilliant to just be like, I talk about this in terms of Medicare for All. These Republican idiots think that they're like, oh, well, Sanders wants to raise your taxes. And he's like, yes, the taxes will go up and the costs will go down. People love honesty. All they want is authenticity. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what the actual fight on Medicare for All will be is not whether the tax will go up. It's whether you trust that the cost will go down. That is what the fight will be over. Not over, oh, he says he's going to raise your taxes. Forget about it. He admits it. That's the whole thing. And that people love that about it.
Yeah.
It was the same thing with Trump. And it's just, they don't even have the framework to understand what we're talking about. And that's what really worries me. But no, I don't think the socialist attack will work.
I mean, that was the thing with Trump, is he would say these things that no consultant would ever tell you to say. And people read that as like, oh, he's honest. It's kind of the same thing with embracing a label that every consultant in this town would be like, you can't say that. And by being like, yeah, I'm a democratic socialist, to most people that reads, oh, he's straightforward with this. He's honest, right? So I also think it sort of baits Republicans into a conversation about economics, which is a very, which is where Sanders ultimately and where Democrats should ultimately want to fight these battles.
Last thing for me is, Sagar, what do you think the future of the Republican Party is? Let's just say if Trump loses, because I think that's an interesting question, right? Do the people who were the traditional Republican intelligentsia, the people who ran the party, are they going to reassert control, or is it going to continue going in that economic populist direction that maybe like Tucker Carlson represents? Like, what's going to happen going forward?
Well, so it's going to be one of the great civil wars of all time, because part of the thing that Trump, to my dismay, really has welcomed the establishment forces within. So the people in this town who wear MAGA hats and shout about drain the swamp are often the swampiest people themselves. And then, so what the real fight is going to be is about what Make America Great Again meant in 2016. You're going to see Paul Ryan's wing of the GOP, who is going to run if Trump loses, and they're going to say, what Trump ran on was tax cuts. That's what Make America Great Again was all about. And then you're going to have a much more populist direction and be like, no. What we're talking about is a rejection of free market orthodoxy, of trade orthodoxy, and an embrace of a class view of politics. Now, I won't sit here and predict. I think the base is always going to be on Trump and a Tucker Carlson side. But like I did with Bernie, I don't underestimate the Chamber of Commerce. They're not stupid. They know exactly how to co-opt that message and be like, we're going to make America great again with tax cuts and with deregulated derivative markets. That's what it all meant from the very beginning. And I don't underestimate for a second that they won't be able to win. So it will be one of the great fights of all time. One of the things that I am trying to do on the show is lay the intellectual groundwork for the war, because the war is coming even if Trump wins re-election. And because he's just decided to kind of let these more establishment forces in, is anybody can really claim the mantle to Trumpism, because it means whatever you really want it to mean. And I fault the president and his administration more than anything for not making it clear what it actually means. That's why I love that Bernie will just be like, yeah, I'm a democratic socialist. If you're not with me, get out. I think it's perfect.
Crystal Sagar, thank you so much. Congratulations on the amazing success of your book. People should go out and buy it. Populist Guide to 2020.
We're going to write a useful idiot's guide to a populist guide.
Are we
going to
do that?
Okay. Yeah.
We're going to start right after the show.
We love you guys. We appreciate
you. Thank you both.
Thanks so much. Sagar, quickly, is that a half Nelson? What kind of tie is that? What kind of knot is that?
Of course it is. Half Windsor, man.
Half Windsor. Okay, what's great. That? Yeah, exactly. Half Nelson. That's a wrestling move. All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. So I learned something today.
Good. What?
That their book is great. Actually, we read it a while ago.
I was going
to
say.
But it's been cool to watch their success. It shot up through the Amazon rankings. That was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
They're doing great. And, you know, their show is such a thumb in the eye of every television producer who thinks that kind of format can't work. It's hilarious to watch how well it's doing. Yeah. So I think that's really cool. It's always great to check in with them.
They're great.
So while we're here, we might as well do our wrap-ups of the debate before they happen, because we're going to say the same things no matter what anyway.
Yeah, so by the time this is released, the debates will have happened, but we won't have seen, and we will have seen them.
We will have seen it.
We're recording pre-debate. We're basically owning that we haven't seen the debates, but we're going to respond to them anyway.
Right.
Because that's how committed we are to providing you with a good show.
Right.
Right? So here's what I thought. I thought Bernie was great.
Wow, what a surprise.
I thought Bernie was great.
I'm just blown away that you think that.
He did a great job. He was authentic. He had great moments. I loved what he said about working people and sticking to the issues. I loved his zingers against Mike Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Mike Bloomberg came off like a whiny...
Stentorian.
Snobbish.
Aristocratic.
Fake New York accent.
Self-satisfied.
Preening. Bostonian. Goblin of a man, yeah. The most annoying was probably...
Chuck Todd.
Oh, my God. Chuck Todd was the worst.
As a friend of mine calls him, Tuck Chod.
He's the worst. Also, what's up with his facial hair? It's really hideous.
I don't know. It is what it is.
The facial hair combined with... It's like, is he wearing a toupee?
I don't know.
Like a thing was dropped on his head.
I think he's going for this like neo-Klingon thing. It kind of works for me. I don't know if I really have a take except that it was really gross and I didn't really want to watch it all the way to the end. And I didn't feel any more rewarded having watched it than I would have had I not watched it. And also I was disgusted by the way they decided that Klobuchar was the clear winner of the debate.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Which is going to happen.
The only question is which
happened. Right, exactly. Within 3 minutes of the end of the debate.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think of their outfits?
On stage, I don't know. I never really pay attention to the outfits. What did you think of Bloomberg's tie?
I thought it was corporate.
Do you think he was standing on a platform?
Yeah, a platform of hate.
So that's what we think of the debate. If you need for us to have watched it, then you might be sorely disappointed. But that's our take anyway.
I think you won't be. I think you'll have found this very good. Probably one of the best post-debate analysis.
Whatever, yeah. We're wrecking the space-time continuum.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so that was Useful Idiots. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.